Okay, it is my privilege and honor to introduce our speakers. Our first speaker panelist is Chris H.
Okay, hi, I'm Chris.
Hi, Chris.
I am really excited to be able to speak today. I'm 7 years old in Al-Anon, which is, when I came in, 7 years seemed so old, and now it seems so young. It's crazy. And the topic that they asked me to talk about tonight, they said how I came in to Al-Anon, or then they added, or any experience, strength, or hope I wanted to share. And I'm like, I'm an Al-Anon. I need direction. You know, tell me what. So I'm going to talk on how I got here. And how this program actually, I think, saved my life and has changed me. So the short answer on how I got here is, and I didn't realize this when I came in, but when I came in, I was making my life unmanageable. And I had a higher power that led me here. And the long answer has a little more nuance, and so I'll touch on it. And I'll start with a teaser. My first Al-Anon meeting, you know, I had to work up courage to go to this meeting, and it probably took me, I don't know, 2 weeks to work up courage, find a location. I was going to go to this meeting, and I show up at the church, and there's a sign on the door telling me that the meeting has been moved, and it's an hour later. And I did not have the courage or the fortitude at that point to go to a room, to a restaurant of people I didn't know, and meet them. But I learned a very important lesson that day, which is keep coming back. Because I did go to another meeting 2 days later at the same church, a different meeting, and I walked in, and I had been living in a fog bank of isolation, and just the love and support that was shown to me as a newcomer kept me coming back. So, and I'm slowly working the program. So how did I get here? How did I get here? I was born the youngest of two children. My dad is an engineer. He's a ham radio enthusiast, and later he became a marathoner. So with all that, you can imagine, I didn't spend a lot of time with him. My mom was what I would call an enthusiastic drinker. I can't call her an alcoholic, but the impact on me was as if she was. So the disease of alcoholism affected me whether she was or not. And then on top of that, my family was a STEM family. My dad was an engineer. My mom was a computer programmer and a bridge tournament master. My brother became a doctor. And I was kind of the artist of the family. So I felt isolated. I kind of felt like I was adopted because I was different and we didn't communicate well. So I grew up very, very isolated and feeling like a fish out of water. And so growing up in this family, and I don't know that my family was that different than any, Gen X, boomer, latchkey family, but I developed some very strong survival skills, what I'll call survival skills. I learned how to isolate. I learned how to be self-reliant and independent. I became a social chameleon where I could be in any situation and bend into what that situation wanted. And I became an illusionist where I would not let people see me. I could just, put off whatever I wanted to put off to please people and make them like me. And I became an expert in walling myself off so people couldn't see the me inside. And again, looking back, I can see why that is because I didn't like myself. And if I didn't like myself, why would I think anybody else would like me? So went to college, went to grad school, and I married an alcoholic addict. And I'm not labeling her that. She has self-labeled herself that. And the good news is she is coming up on 2 years sober, and she's active in her program. But I'm not really going to talk much about her because, this is my Al-Anon-a-log, not a drunk-a-log. So, but I brought my survival skills to the marriage. I took up the role of husband and father, and this is where my Al-Anon disease really started to come out. I can see that my marriage to my ex was an exercise of my survival skills. Again, it's funny to call them skills because they were moral defects or destructive tendencies that I had that I'd learned how to cope and survive. But the nature of both of our diseases together, probably why I was attracted to an alcoholic in the first place, was because it allowed me to not really intimately engage with another person. So I could be in a marriage and keep myself safe and walled off, or at least what I thought was safe and walled off. And so, I had a relationship with low intimacy and a low risk of exposing myself. And in exchange, I assumed responsibility for everything. We had three kids, and slowly I became parent to four kids as her disease progressed in her life. I was the disciplinarian, the problem solver, the financial provider. Everything was on my shoulders, especially in my mind. I was bearing everything was in my mind. I was responsible. I had a very demanding job. And towards the end of the marriage, I became what I call a yoga master, where I could contort myself in so many ways to make things happen. And what my life felt like at this time was I felt like I was on a football field, right? And that football field was full of spinning plates. And I was responsible to run that entire field and keep all those plates spinning. And if one of them fell, just one of them fell, the world would blow up. And that was the pressure that I put myself under. Now, earlier in our marriage, my ex had identified herself as an alcoholic and an addict. And she had her struggle and things like that. But I, you know, in my self-reliance and everything, I thought that all she had to do was just stop. You know, just stop. Make that choice. You know, you've got kids, you've got this, just stop. I didn't understand the disease of alcoholism. I did not understand the disease of addiction. And I was, again, independent and self-reliant, so I didn't reach out for help. I didn't know what Al-Anon was. You know, I just didn't. It's funny because my kids have accused Al-Anon of being a cult. Like, you're in this cult. And when I first heard Al-Anon, I thought the same thing, you know. So what I did was I really did my version of white knuckling. You know, I toughed it out, and I figured, oh, we'll have an alcohol-free house. It'll be easy. She can't get alcohol anywhere else if it's not in the house, right? So, yeah. I became increasingly unhappy as this was going on, but I just figured that's what life was. You know, I came to a place where life was just a dark place, and I chose wrong, and I was just going to have to endure it. And so I was pretty miserable. And obviously my ex was not happy either. We did not have a happy relationship at this time. And she dealt with it in her way, which eventually led to individual and couples therapy. And the funny thing is, before we got married, I'd seen a couple therapists, right? But once we got married, I never did, because it was always her problem, right? She's the one who had the problem, so she had to fix it. She had to go to a doctor. It was never me who had to go to a doctor. But this time I went to a doctor, and it was really a God shot, because while I was talking to this doctor one day, she said to me, "Have you ever heard the term codependency?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm familiar with the term." And she said, "Well, you should read about it." And so I did what every educated person does. I went to a library, and I checked out Codependency for Dummies. I did, and I read it, and there on every single page I saw myself. And it's not conference-approved literature, but on page 95 it says, "Attending 12-step meetings is the ideal way to begin recovery." And I looked through the choices of 12 steps, and I said, okay, AA, that doesn't work for me, NA, no, CODA, I don't even know what that is, you know, just go through them all. And Al-Anon seemed to make sense, and that was how I reached out to my first meeting, and that what I told you about when I went to my first meeting. And that's what started my recovery. And this was really a God shot to me. It really was my higher power at work. I can look back now and see that, because when I started Al-Anon, I started for my codependency. That's why I came in. I was in such denial, even though my ex had described herself as an alcoholic and an addict. You know, we didn't have an alcohol. I wasn't really there for alcoholism. I was there for my codependency. And so I had a good 6 months of starting, finding a sponsor, starting to work the steps. And then the disease of alcoholism just blew up my marriage in a really traumatic and painful way. And the beauty of it, again, was if it had happened before I came into the rooms, I don't know that I would have survived. But at least I had a base to start working on, and I had a support group, which I didn't have when I come in. I had isolated myself completely. I mean, the way I used to describe it was I was living in a fog bank, and the first meeting I went to was like a lighthouse cutting through that fog bank, and all of a sudden there was hope. I could find a safe port. And so because of going to this, when things blew up, I actually had people I could reach out to and talk through and talk me off the ledge as you know, bad things happened. And my sponsor said something to me, he said it a lot to me. He's like, in God's eyes, I'm not unique. I'm precious, but not unique. And that was something I had to really learn. Because again, even 6 months in, as alcohol's blowing up my family, I remember thinking to myself, well, she's not that kind of alcoholic. You know, I remember those thoughts, and I could look back at it and laugh. But that was like what was honestly in my mind. And the thing that was interesting, I think, as I look back at my journey, is I came in, for me, feeling responsible for everything, but also with low self-esteem and not feeling like there. The way I look at it is I was omnipotent but incompetent, if that makes sense. It's like, I don't know how I could be that, but that's what I was. And then as I got into the program, my view started to shift, right? And then I blamed my ex for everything. You know, so it wasn't my fault anymore, but I kept coming back. And during this time, a brother in the program would listen to my diatribes about my ex, about anybody who pissed me off, anything that was going on. And he would listen just calmly after meetings. And he would ask me, he would say, "And what does that say about you?" And that would piss me off probably more than whatever I just complained about. It's like, did you not hear what I just said? I'm the victim here. Did you not get this? And again, calmly, and what does that say about you? And that was the question that I needed to hear. Because it was through him and other people in this program that I learned that while we call this a we program, you know, it's a me program. For me, my recovery is a me program. It's about me. It's about my feelings, my thoughts, my reactions, learning about those things that involve me and those things that I'm actually responsible for, not the things that I just assume responsibility for. So I am recovering. I'm a much better person when I came to this program. But those tendencies still come up, and that's why I keep coming back, is because I have to be in an attitude of recovery. I have to be talking to people in recovery so I stay that way. And one of the blessings, one of the many blessings of this program, is about how to relate with others that I've learned. One of the real keys is learning how to pause, right? When I came in, my old style was to hibernate and run from confrontation, right? It wasn't really pause, it was just avoid. You know, you've heard all the different anagrams or abbreviations for fear. Mine was F everything and run. You know, that was what I would do. I just don't want it. I'm getting out of here. And I got shamed for that too. That I wouldn't, you know, that I would avoid controversy or confrontation. And what I've learned now, and this was an important lesson for me, what I've learned in my life, for most situations, if it's important, it's not urgent. And if it's urgent, it's not important. And what that basically means, I mean, you think of like the TV ads, like, act now, and they put this false sense of urgency. Most situations where I've got urgency involved, it's because of, you know, it's an ego-driven thing. It's not reality-based, it's ego-driven. I want it done. And I've learned that most important things deserve the ability to stop and think about it, to ponder it. You know, what I like to do is I think of it as like I'm allowing something to percolate so I know how I feel about it and what the appropriate reaction is. In a related program that I attended, and it focuses on couples in recovery, one of the things that I learned from them was really powerful was when there's an important issue, you actually make an appointment to talk about it. So you don't talk about it, you know, it's like, it's not 3 a.m, we got to solve it now. It's like, you know, that's really important. Can we talk about that Saturday at 5 o'clock? And the power of that is for someone like me, it gives me the blessing that it's okay that I don't have to deal with it right now. And for somebody who, you know, it's urgent, I've got to deal with it, they know it's not being blown off. They know we're going to talk about it. There's a time we're going to talk about it. I thought it was a beautiful compromise. So another key in my program has been acceptance. I have expended a lot of energy denying the past and trying to change it. Another brother in the program introduced me to page 417 of the Big Blue Book. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today, which I read regularly as part of my spiritual practice. I've memorized it and say it often. And it's big for me because I always confused acceptance with approval. You know, I figured if something happened and I accepted that it happened, I was approving it. But acceptance just simply for me means acknowledging that a person, place, thing, or situation is exactly how it is at the moment. My reaction to that person, place, thing, or situation is completely unrelated to the fact that it exists. I mean, you've heard the phrase, I'm sure, it is what it is. And, you know, I had a girlfriend who hated it whenever I would say, it is what it is, and she would just like get crazy with it. But I think if you break that phrase down, that's acceptance in a nutshell. You know, you take away the kind of implied passive-aggressive, well, it is what it is and nothing's going to change it, which is where it's used. But that's it. It is what it is. That's what acceptance is. And if something exists, for me, the next question, which is unrelated, is how does that make me feel? Right? So it is what it is. How do I feel about it? And pause comes into play there because it gives me that break to process from acceptance to action, which is related to how do I feel about it? My action is me dictated by how I actually feel about it. Do I want to change it, or do I think it's a good thing, or where it is? So for an example of this is Forever, way before program, a tool that I always used when I had a decision and I wasn't sure what to do is I'd flip a coin, right? And I'd see what the result was. And it wasn't really about the result. It was about my feelings about the result. I'd look at it, flip the coin. If it was heads and I was disappointed, I know, okay, maybe I wanted tails. So, and that's the same kind of thing. It's like learning what my reaction is, feeling my reaction, and being able to act on it. So, this also happened in relationships. Early on, before a year, I moved on from the third step to the 13th step. I don't recommend, you hear from your sponsors, those of you, don't do anything for a year. That's really good advice. But looking back at the relationship and other relationships, I can see that my disease expressed itself by holding on to what I wanted something to be rather than what it was. I did not accept the person or the relationship for what it was, and I saw it as what I thought it should be, and that led me to hang on when I shouldn't have. And something I've learned now is that, you know what? Acceptance doesn't mean I have to like it or not like it, and even in relationships, I have to accept the relationship the way it is and learn to deal with it the way it is rather than the way I want it to be. I'll give you another example, and this one's kind of funny. And it's about choice. You know, it's like learning that I have choices. My ex was a hairstylist, and she cut my hair for over 20 years, right? And finally, as things are going down, I imposed a really solid boundary. I said, "You can't cut my hair anymore." I kept coming back, but that was my boundary, and so then I went, you know, to enforce my boundary, and I went to a hairstylist to ask her to cut my hair, and I sit in the chair, and she's all, "Well, what would you like me to do?" And I had no answer, because I'd never thought that, oh, I have a choice in what my hair should look like, right? And today I'm completely responsible. Sorry, but anyways. But the other thing that I learned from that is I exercised this you know, boundary, and I hadn't really accepted the situation because I hadn't thought the consequences, the things that I had to do by enforcing this strong boundary, that I had to make choices about what I looked like. So, but accepting I have a choice and a say has been powerful. Before, I lived in a fear of disappointing others because I valued what they wanted more than I valued what I wanted. Now, I ask myself a question, and it's a really important question. I ask myself this question, how do I want to feel? You know, at the end, how do I want to feel? And I can let that percolate, I can let that go, and it can guide my reaction. And it helps me into a dialogue, not a debate, not an argument, a dialogue. And sometimes there's compromise because I'm not going to get everything that I want and they may not get everything they want, but at least I know that my choice is as valid as theirs and I can argue from a, or I can argue, I can discuss from a, you know, from a place of self-love rather than self-loathing. So listening to me, you can probably hear I still overthink any situation. Oftentimes my initial reaction is overreaction, but because I've learned to pause, a lot of times that initial reaction is inside my head and nobody ever knows it, and that's a strength. I came to Al-Anon because my responses were not working for me anymore, and my higher power put me in these rooms to learn how to healthily respond to life. If I had not come in from the stress that I was under, I think I would have had a stroke or be dead. But working the steps, sharing experience, strength, and hope with fellow Al-Anons, talking it out with core program people. For those of you who are new, find friends in the program that you can talk to. That phone is heavy, but use it. And I have tools now to process life as it happens. And I know when I need to respond, and usually I respond appropriately. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. So please all welcome Jesse.
I am Jesse. I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. Bear with me here. I keep yawning because I have a 7-month-old and she wanted to party twice last night. So I'm just like, there's not enough caffeine in the world for me right now. But I've been in Al-Anon for a long time. I'm a teenager now, and so I have so much. I've gotten so much for this program, and I get to live a life today that I never thought, you know, that I would have. I have a design for living today that I didn't have when I came into Al-Anon. And so I'll just start from the beginning. I didn't grow up in a home where my parents were alcoholics, but they were Al-Anons. They were affected by the disease of alcoholism. My sister now identifies as an alcoholic, so I can say that 2 years in, I was definitely affected by alcoholism, like right out of the gate, I feel like. And it's not what brought me in. I think today, the way that I practice my program does help me with her because she is the alcoholic in my life now. And I just love her to death. I just so grateful for all the alcoholics in my life because they got me here, and I don't want to be anywhere else. What brought me in was the relationships. You know, it's not that the relationship brought me in so much, but like the fact that I was in a relationship with somebody who got into AA. So I met my first alcoholic when I was 15. He was stealing alcohol from his, you know, parents' alcohol cabinet and huffing whipped cream cans, and it was, and he was like, you know, we were like just lost souls, you know, and then I just, like, I felt like he just, you know, like, I was going to be his person, and he was going to be my person, and I was really depressed at that time, and I, you know, nothing was going to work out, but, like, I was going to have my person, and he was going to be the thing that, like, you know, made everything complete. I think I look back now after being in Al-Anon and having a God and having spirituality, that I was always looking for God. I was looking for God, but I didn't realize I was looking for God, and I was looking for it in other people, and I was looking for it in other things, and I didn't, And obviously that it never, you know, it never materialized, because that's not where we find God. And the people that we try to find God in, it's like, they'll never be that. And so, you know, very, very soon in, it was like, wait, you're not doing the thing that you're supposed to be doing for me. And instead of going, oh, maybe there's something else for me, or maybe there's a, you know, more healthy relationship I could get in, it was like, no, I'm going to control and manipulate and do all the things, and I'm going to make this relationship into this thing that I need. And that's what I did. And it didn't work very well. About a couple years in, I started going to therapy, because I'm like, I know this is an unhealthy relationship and I need to get out of it, but I can't. I can't bring myself to get out of it, because, like, he was my, like, if I didn't know if I was like, I can't let go. I can't let go, because if I let go, what's going to happen to me? Like, what's going to happen to me? Like, there's not going to be another person. My person's not going to be gone. And so I'm going to therapy, still can't leave him. His alcoholism progresses, and then he's doing all kinds of stuff. And then he gets sober, and he goes to AA, and he meets up with me one night, and he's like, I found God. I was like, what? We're like little goth kids. Like, we're definitely atheists. We're like, that's not in our realm. And when he tells me he found God, I was like, what are you talking about? But he's like really in a good place, I can tell. Like, he's like not anything I had ever experienced before with him. And I was like, okay. And then he starts doing all these things. He's going to meetings. He's got friends all of a sudden in the program. And I was like, well, what about me? Like, you know, like, you're my person, and you're out like doing all this stuff. And I don't have anybody, because the disease, my disease is very isolating. I didn't have friends. I relied on him to be my person and his friends to be my friends, and like, I didn't have my own life. And my therapist goes, well, there's a place for you too, thank God. And I said, oh, really? And so I don't know how I found the first meeting that I found, but it was in Westlake. And I started going. So at the time, I was 19 when I got in there. And right off the bat, I was like, these are my people. Like, and I didn't go there to get somebody. I didn't go there to get somebody sober. He was actually, my first alcoholic was actually nicer when he was drinking, so I didn't really want to stop his drinking. So that wasn't really my problem, but my behavior was the problem. And so when I went in there and everybody else is talking about their behavior, even though they were talking about their kids, I was like, I get it, totally makes sense. But it was hard coming in young. And it's really important that I talk about this, because when we see young people coming into the rooms, it's so important that we greet them and we treat them just as the same as anybody else. Because, yes, like, you know, I didn't have a lifetime worth of pain, but what was happening to me at that time, I was already, that behavior, that Al-Anon behavior was already happening. And I didn't start typing myself again, so that's important. Okay. And so, you know, I asked somebody to be my sponsor. They said no. I stayed for a year. And then I had 8 years of more alcoholics. And then I finally came back. So, yes. But in that time, you know, like, I moved in with an alcoholic for 5 years, and I didn't like his drinking, and I did try to stop his drinking, and there was a lot going on there. As the speaker talked about earlier, I did have many overlapping relationships that I'm not proud of, but I think it's really important that we say it from the podium, because I needed to hear that from other women, and I didn't hear it for a while when I came in. And so it was like, well, nobody's going to be able to hear my four-step, because like, I'm going to talk about these things that nobody else has done, and I was like, I don't know about being honest about this stuff. And so when I heard it, it was really important. So I say that for that reason. And anyway, so I go out. I'm out for 8 years. I date alcoholic after alcoholic, and then I finally get to a heroin addict. And and I was like, what is this? I you know, like, I was like, my 5-year relationship was like a very classic alcoholic, and like, it was, you know. And then heroin, you know, like, he's going to the bathroom all the time. He's got a little purse. I'm like, what's happening? And very soon into that relationship, I realized that he was using. I'm like, of course he is, because this is what I do. I find more alcoholics. And he got into AA, and then I came back a Thank God I came back. I'm so glad that he went to AA. I'm so thankful again to my alcoholics that got recovery before me, because that's why I came back. And he too was like getting busy and he had all these friends and he was going to young people's conventions, and I was like, what the heck? Like, at this age, I'm like already, so I came back when I was 28. I still didn't have a life. I still didn't have friends. Like, and I'm like, so when I came back in, it was like, why am I ending up in the same place over and over and over again? Like, and I was just so done at that point, because I'm like, my behavior, it's like something's wrong. And I came back into the meetings and I was heartbroken, and I just felt lost. And it's so important again that we greet the newcomers, because that first meeting when I came back, someone said hi to me, and she's like, I have a seat by me, and she like led me over and sat me down and introduced me to people. And it was like, that was so important, because I'm an introvert and I'm like, I'm not gonna talk to anybody if I don't have to. And so that was really important. And that time I got a sponsor, thank goodness. and I can't say enough about sponsorship, because my sponsor has she basically raised me again, you know, because I came in, and I say this all the time, that I basically, like, I was emotionally like 13, even though I was 28, you know, because I never quite learned how to have like the those mature conversation, like a communication, or I didn't know how to show up for people. I would say one thing and then do something else. I was lying when I came in. There was a lot of behavior that I was doing that I had I just hadn't learned what I needed to learn. And so when I got my sponsor, she was a very black belt Al-Anon, which I'm glad that I had at that time, because she had me doing so many things, and she was like, you're going to read this, and then I'm chairing a convention, and you're going to go volunteer to be on the convention. And I was like, okay, what's a convention? And
wait, how much time do I have?
Okay. So let's do 9, and then I'll start myself up. Okay. So she had me volunteering on a convention, which was awesome. And then she had me taking commitments, and then, you know, we're going and doing book studies and all this stuff. And I'm so grateful, because service too is just like, I can't say enough about service, because I've done so much service really early on, and it's not only one because of the fellowship, but two because I needed to learn how to do esteemable acts, and because I did not know that when I came in too, like I had a huge ego but really low self-worth. And so, you know, like I was constantly trying to like compensate for that, and I didn't understand what I was doing. But as I started to do service and started to gain self-esteem through that, I started to find like just meaning in my life. And it's not, there's that, but then there's also, you know, I'll talk about God, because that's for me like a huge piece of the pie. And when I came in, like I said, I was making other people my higher power. And I, when I started doing the steps, I did 1, 2, and 3. I think I did them, but I didn't really do them. And then I got to 6 and 7, and my sponsor was like, I think you need to go back. And so I went back, and I did 1, 2, and 3 again, and I started to realize that, like, okay, this is like dating. You know, like, I gotta, like, kind of get to know this God and, like, spend time with them. And, like, it was, like, a more intimate experience that I got to have, and that I'm so glad she sent me back, because I really got to spend time on that. And it was really, and my God has evolved from like big hands to like big purple, like I call, say, like, I had a big purple ape, like, big fluffy ape that would hug me, like, but today, like, I just, it's just the energy that runs through everything now. For me, my higher power is the energy that runs through everything, and that everything's connected, which is great for me, because that's how I can let things go and turn things over, because if it's all connected, and it's all happening the way it's supposed to be happening, and there's nothing I have to do to control it. There's nothing I have to, and I can let it go, because my thing is, like I talked about before, my relationships, it's like I'm going to hold on for dear life, and I'm not going to let anything go, because what if I don't, then what's going to happen? But today I know, like, what's going to happen is going to happen. It's going to happen the way it's supposed to happen, and I know that today, and I'm so grateful. And my new explanation of my God is an Etch-a-Sketch, where, like, I'm one knob and God's the other knob, and we're, like, building together, and we got this, like, whole, like, picture going, and then all of a sudden God goes and, like, I have a better idea. God's just like, I had a better idea. And, like, when I think about it like that, like, God's got a better idea than I have, then it's, you know, it's, everything's going to work out, and I can relax, because I couldn't relax before program. I was, like, so uptight, and believe me, I can get back there in a second if I'm not working my program and I don't wake up and turn it over. But today, it's like, when I came into program when I was that 16-year-old, it's like, everything's going to go wrong. Everything is going to go wrong. It's like super doom and gloom. It's like, everything's, you know, going to go wrong. And today, it's like, no, not everything is going to go wrong. It's like, things could go right, you know, and, like, I just didn't know that before, and like, I have the choice to, like, to be there today, to do that, and what else do I want to talk about? There's so much. So just, I also, the steps, all obviously, you know, like, I found the relief. When I first came in when I was 19, I had the relief, but I didn't work the program. Like, I didn't work the steps, and I didn't have a sponsor. And my sponsor has taught me so much. He's pushed me to, like, be a better person. And I got the relief from the meetings, and I found fellowship. And so I'm not, you know, like, I have all these friends, and I'm not lonely anymore. But the steps, like, really changed my perspective, and, like, really got me to, like, dig deeper and, like, really find some different solutions and different perspectives of seeing the world. And so I can't say enough about the steps. And today, like, working my sponsees keep me really humble, and humility is probably one of the biggest gifts of this program, because, you know, especially today, so I have a 7-month-old and I have a 5-year-old, and today it's like, I'm not going to do everything perfect, and I want to, you know, I'm an Al-Anon, I want to do everything perfect, and I can't, and I'm not going to, but I have humility today, so when I do mess up and I do something that I'm not proud of and I didn't like the way that I did it, I can go to my 5-year-old and I say, you know what, mommy was wrong. You know, I shouldn't have done that. And this is how I want to be. And I get to do that today because I've done my 4-step. Like, I know my character defects. I know my stuff. And I've done my amends, and I know how to make amends today. And so I don't have to carry that around. We know, like, if I do something, I don't have to carry it around anymore. Like, I get to make it right. I get to make it right today. And that feels so amazing, and another one of the gifts of this program. And, gosh, sponsorship. 3 minutes. Okay. yeah, there's so much. Like, there's so much in this program. Sponsorship steps, service. I've learned so much again about service. Like, I've learned so much through service and about the traditions. And I had the pleasure of helping to create a young people's convention, which don't think it didn't survive, but we learned so much in doing it. There was three that were put on, and I learned so much about working with others and doing that, being on a committee and working with others and learning that, like, my way is not the only way, and that the beauty of diversity and other people's opinions. And, like, today, like, I can enter business meetings with a light heart and, like, have a sense of humor and, like, know that, like, if it's not my way, then it's going to be okay. And, like, there's, you know, there's just other ways of doing things, and I didn't have that coming in. And yeah, so I will just go ahead and I'll end you with my prayer that I do with my 5-year-old, the way that my last sponsor taught me. We say the Serenity Prayer, and then we end it with, God, thank you. Leave me where you need me, and surprise me.
And let's please welcome Brandy.
I don't have a time. I'm giving up all control. I'm not bringing my clock.
Okay. That's fine.
Just give me. Hi, guys. I'm Randy.
Hi, Randy.
I want to thank the readers and my co-partners here and the people that put on this convention. What an awesome place. And welcome to everybody. And if you're new, welcome again. Experience, strength, and hope. So I'm going to talk a little bit from the parent perspective. Even though I'm an adult child of an addict, but a sex addict. So not a drug addict or an alcoholic, but a sex addict. So some of those characteristics that I grew up with, abandonment and the lying and the cheating and the not being around, affected me. You know, it affected me as if I had an alcoholic as a parent. And the way I dealt with that as a child was that I took control. Perfect, right, Al-Anon, right? I took control of things. I made sure my sisters were in bed. I'm the oldest of three. Made sure they were in bed on time. Would wait up with my mom until my dad came home, or didn't, and usually didn't. She'd fall asleep on the couch. I'd wake her up and say, hey, it's time to go to bed, you know. Made sure the doors were locked. So I took on this parent role very, very young. And some of those coping skills as a child didn't bode very well for me as an adult. They became character defects. And I didn't know that. That's not the reason why I came into program. I came into program because I have 3 children. I have a beautiful wife who's here with me tonight, this afternoon. Been married for 39 years. And not bad, huh? And one of the things that happened was we were just young and free and having children and living a good life, and things were really good until the phone call from school. You know, we noticed that our middle child was a little bit different in the fact that he was just rambunctious. He was diagnosed with ADHD. I would have been diagnosed with ADHD too, probably, because I was typical young boy, right? Just doing things, climbing trees, not listening to the teacher, just, you know, busy, right? So that kind of was a little bit of a red flag, but progressively, we started going to therapists, and they started putting him on medications, and we're not sure, but looking back, I don't know if we would have done that again, thinking that putting our trust in a therapist and, you know, putting him on medication, Ritalin, whatnot, to calm him down, but things got progressively worse, and I don't want to talk too much about that because there's so much to say and not much time. But what happens is, for us, we struggle with that because we were trying to fix it. And I was an overreactor and a fixer. And I thought I had all the right answers. And I wanted to be the best dad I could be because I didn't have that example growing up. I wanted to be the dad that, you know, my uncles were the ones that took me to Little League and to baseball and, you know, all the Pop Warner sports and all that. So I wanted to be that dad, and I was. I was the soccer coach. I was the basketball coach. Both my boys knew how to ride bikes at 2.5, 3 years old. So they were very athletic, pretty well academically, but not great. But they were just. I was just proud and happy. And then we had our daughter about 6 years later, and so I was on top of the world. Everything was great. And then, you know, school came, middle school came, and things were getting a little bit difficult for my middle son. Acting out, and just so the focus became on him. That was it. Everybody else was gone, and the focus was on the problem. We were going to fix it. And we tried everything, you know. Progressively, things got worse with him and his behavior. Knew nothing about Al-Anon, knew nothing about alcoholism, knew nothing about AA. I was just a young kid who sampled a lot of things, found things I really liked, experimented with a lot of things, but I didn't have that gene, thank God, of addiction. I was able to put it down. It didn't destroy relationships, it didn't destroy work ethics or anything like that. I just had fun with it. When high school came, my middle son was on the water polo team. He was the star water polo player. We had Abercrombie and Fitch models running around the house. If any of you know what those are, they're just... And I was really a proud dad. You know, he had a car, he was going to school, things were really good. You know, he was living a good life, and my older son was, you know, doing great. He graduated. They all graduated. But in his senior year, things got really rough. My wife had back surgery, and she was prescribed medication, and we noticed, I used to have to break the pills in half because she couldn't take many, so, you know, and they used to prescribe big jars back then, and so I'd break them in half when she would take one, and she wore them around her neck, and one day I came home, and there was like 50 of them were gone. It's like, so where there's smoke, there's fire, right? So we knew something was going on. That was kind of during the opiate crisis, if you, most of you remember that, and so he got very involved with opiates, and he didn't really drink much. He just drank to wash down the pills. He was doing Xanax and opiates. And, you know, I thought maybe a little pot here and there, which is normal. Everyone does it and tries it. And now it's legal. It's like you don't even know. But back then it was different. So, and by the way, now my boy is, my oldest is 31, and my daughter's 26. So they're grown adults. I call them children, but they're grown adults. Anyway, I love my son. I hate the disease. So progressively, I try to say this without crying because it just chokes me up. We've been through so much, you know. So one of the panelists was talking a little bit about, they both were a little bit about God and faith in the program. And I heard at a parent meeting that religion is for those who believe in hell. Spirituality is for those who have been there. I just thought I'd throw that out. I kind of like that. Because we've been through hell. We've been through so much. My son really, really had a rough road. We had to ask him to leave, which was really hard. Detaching with love. We hear that, you know. I always thought detaching with love was severing our relationship. Like, that's it, you're done, you're out. And I learned in program that detaching with love is loving him and giving him the dignity to learn on his own. I did a lot of things that I failed at, and my parents weren't there to rescue me. I was the guy running around with that pillow to catch him every time because I thought I had the right idea, the best answer, the way to fix it. And as I kept coming to the meeting, well, let me go back a little bit. So we had a fork in the road. We had to do something because we couldn't accept unacceptable behavior anymore. You know, they say it's a program of contrary action. Nothing changes if we don't change something. We had to change something. And that was we didn't kick him out. We asked him to leave. We could not live with his behavior anymore. It got to the point where we were locking our doors. You know, we were finding foils and jewelry was missing, and it was just cars were being crashed. There was a lot of wreckage, a lot of wreckage. And my wife went through this with her brother, who was a heroin addict, who wasn't with us any longer. He died 6 years ago from alcoholism. The disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And you know, a good friend of mine in program says, someone hurt me and I got lucky because I found this program. You know, we're lucky. We're all lucky to be here because this program really, it's a blueprint for life. You know, it's changed me. I was such a shy kid in middle school, high school. I never stood up and read my report out loud. I was hiding in the back. And here I am now standing in front of you. And I never in a million years imagined this. But it's the miracles of these programs. And they say, stick around for the miracle. Being in Parent Focus Al-Anon, I've been in program for 11 years, and my regular meetings are the Tradition 5 Woodland Hills meeting and the Wednesday night Parent Focus meeting, and I also attend Men's Stag meetings. And I've been to 6 funerals since I've been in program. And dear friends, people that I came in with that our kids were doing drugs together, and they lost their son or their daughter because of fentanyl or whatnot. And it's brutal. It's just heart-wrenching. And their families are small, but they have huge Al-Anon families with them. I mean, hundreds of people showed up from program to support them. And that's what we do. We're not alone. We have people. We can reach, pick up that phone and call somebody when something's wrong or when you're hurting. You know, when we let my son go and had to kick him out and watch him in the dark of night walking down the street, it was heart-wrenching, you know. I mean, that's one of the hardest things as a parent you have to do. And that's when I really hit my knees. I came in and I just looked up and went, God, what do I do? I didn't know what to do. And because it's scary, you know, you love this kid and you have to let him go into the world. And but that's where I found strength, was sponsorship. I was able to call my sponsor. I was able to reason it out with people that have done it before me, people that have let their children go, and give them the dignity to learn, like I learned, like we all learned, you know, most of us. I can speak for myself. I learned the hard way too. I did a lot of things I regretted, a lot of things I'm ashamed of, but I learned from my mistakes. And his journey, my son's bottom had trapdoors. You know, he started doing really bad things with really bad people, and we were really scared because, you know, he was in and out of many jails. He was up here in your area. He was up even up here in Ventura County for a year. And he was in, you know, Men's Central for a year, and he was at Wayside. And then things got, you know, he got out, and he came home. After his second rehab, he came home, and we thought, great, we got this. He's going to be like a shiny new penny. He's got his 30 days. He went through the program. He's going to be all fixed. Just what we wanted, right? Came home. 2 weeks later, he's back on meth and heroin. It's baffling, but you know, it's powerful. And only an addict or an alcoholic can free another addict or alcoholic. We couldn't do it. And we really had to just kind of let go and let go, let God. It's like, you know, they say let go or be dragged. It took a long time to let go of the reins and stop being dragged. And I know it's really difficult for a lot of people, but we all get there when we're ready. You know, we all get there when we're ready. I mean, we have parents at our parent meeting that have 52-year-olds still drinking on their couch. And they're making a breakfast, and they're not working, and they're home. It's just, you know, I mean, they say that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. So it's like, when do we know? We know when we're ready, you know, we know when we know. We all get to that point individually. My wife and I came into the program together. I really bought into it, and she was like, I don't know about those people. They got a lot of problems, and we're not like them. And you know, I'd go, well, I kind of like what they're saying. I really like listening. And I sat in the back, and I was teared up. And then, she, you know, we'd come, and then she would run away, and then come. And then I kept coming back. And things were changing, and she saw what she liked in me. She saw things were different. My relationships were different with the other two kids. She liked that, so she came back. And now we're both in it together. And we both have sponsors, and we both get to be of service. And it's a real treat being asked to come up and share because, you know, I said, my story's long, but I'm going to try to keep it within the minutes I have. The hardest part, I know some of us are still living in pain and living with alcoholism, active alcoholism and addiction, and it's heart-wrenching. And we weren't on the same page, and that made it more difficult. That was the really hardest part because, you know, the addict and alcoholic know how to tear a family apart. They know where the weak link is. And believe me, they know. And we, you know, they talk about don't, you know, in the do's and don'ts, they talk about don't be a doormat. We were the wall-to-wall carpet. I mean, it was bad. We were just like, you know, because we just thought, oh, you know, we can't control it, can't cure it. Oh, I forgot the other one. Can't cure it. Three C's. Control it, but you can contribute to it. There's a fourth C. My sponsor told me you're contributing to it. And we were, by giving him an allowance, paying him $20 to back him just to get him out of the house for the day. So he can go get his heroin and get out. Just go, you know. I mean, sometimes when they're high, it's easier to deal with than when they're sober, right? And so it was just a really, it's been a rough going. And while my son was on his journey, doing the best he could, my older son got bladder cancer at 25 years old or something. You know, he went surfing. We're surfers, my son and all of us are. But, and he was surfing with some friends, and he got out of the water, and, you know, went in the bushes, took a pee, and there was blood, and he was afraid to tell us, and he finally told us. And my wife said, "You got to go to the doctor tomorrow." So we took him, and he had bladder cancer. He's okay. But I had a son in prison and a son with bladder cancer and a daughter dating a drug addict all at once. So if anything, I can be an example of hope for those of you going through tough times. Because, you know, life is, God puts these things, obstacles in our way to make me stronger. It's made me a stronger person. I just recently, a year ago, this August, I went in for an exam, and they said, "Well, you need a body scan." They found an aneurysm in one of my arteries. And if I didn't get it done, I could have died. And, you know, I didn't even think about it until I was going into the hospital for the surgery. I'm thinking, shit, it could have all been over if I didn't have this God shot of me getting this body scan for some reason that was covered by insurance. And it was like, I was so affected by that. And I was like, and it's gone now, because 2 weeks after that, I was just thinking, my God, I'm lucky to be alive. And now that life's back in session, it's kind of in the past, but I'm really blessed. You know, we're all blessed to get up in the morning, just to wake up and put our feet down and not have back pain and get up and do our things, you know. And I've learned in program that I can appreciate every moment. You know, I really can. And for the longest time, I was so arrogant and so bullheaded, like I had all the answers, but I learned. A piece of you is in me. You know, everything that you guys, I listen to meetings, I go to hundreds of meetings, and every time I hear a nugget, it comes into my soul. So what I'm saying is I'm a piece of all of you. Because everything you guys have been through, even though it's a little different, we're all unified by alcoholism or drug addiction. You know, there's a common thread that keeps us all together. And, you know, the unity, recovery, and service is so important. I just want to go back to my son really fast. So he ended up in prison for some things. He got involved with some criminal activity because of drugs and violent stuff. And he ended up in prison for 4 years. You know, the judge had given him a restraining order. We weren't able to see him, talk to him, or no communication for 3 years. So we had Christmas parties and religious events and things, and he wasn't there. And my wife, the tradition was always we set a plate for people that weren't there anymore, her brother and my son. And do I have still have time? Okay. And, you know, it's just hard because, you know, it just brings back those memories, you know, just going through those things and being able to talk about them. I never cried until I saw men cry in men's meetings. I never cried because my dad, I didn't have anyone that example of emotion. And here I am choked up in front of people I don't even know. Well, some of you I do, but it's just difficult to talk about those things because I'm just blessed that we got through it. And my son today, he got out of prison. He ended up in Pelican Bay, up in Crescent City, and we didn't see him for 4 or 5 years, and he got out, and, you know, that phone call comes at 3 a.m, many of you know that, right? Nothing good happens after midnight, but that's when they release him, is at midnight, and he went to the train station, and by the time he got downtown, he'd called, said, I'm coming home, you know, I'm ready, and I said, well, and I'd had program, I didn't stop going to meetings, I didn't stop talking to my sponsor, you know, just because things are good doesn't mean I'm good and I'm leaving, I'm going to be here for a long time, because I need it. It's like, you know, it just keeps me flexed. It keeps me breathing. It keeps me on the right path. You know, I figure I need to be spiritually, mentally, physically, and financially balanced at all times. If one of those isn't in line, then I'm a mess. And coming to meetings gives me that spiritual balance that I really need. But it's a happy ending, my story so far. I mean, the book's not over till I'm gone, right? But the good news is my son got out. He got married 3 weeks ago. Miracle. They say don't leave till the miracle happens. He got married, and we're going to be grandparents, which is another blessing. It's like I never thought in a million years that I could be saying this because I can't tell you how many car accidents, how many, you know, I've seen them carried out in an ambulance. I've seen them carried out in a straitjacket, hogtied, with my daughter and my wife in the car pulling up, seeing him in the street with his face on the ground, you know, tied up like a hog. And just, it's like a miracle. So it's, what I can say is, stick around if you're new, keep coming back, and service. I just want to touch on service really fast. Sponsorship is such an important part of my program. I'm fortunate, I have 5 sponsors. I have a lot of guys that are double winners in multiple programs. And they said, when you want to find a sponsor, find someone sicker than you are. So I found a sponsor that's in 5 programs. But he's a great guy. I love him. He moved to Palm Springs, so I'm not as close as I used to be. But I do talk to him often. I'm not real needy as a sponsor anymore because now I'm working the steps all the time with my guys. But I love being of service. You know, I'm honored to be able to come in and speak when I have an opportunity. I always say yes. And I also believe in helping young people. I'm also an AMIAS. So I'm an Alateen sponsor. And I think that's really important because we've lost so many Alateen meetings because of COVID. And these kids, I was sponsoring these kids at a facility out in Chatsworth. Troubled youths that have foster parents and they're just really in bad shape. I mean, our kids had parents, most of them, but some of these kids are being brought up by their aunts or uncles that are addicts and not in a good place. And I had 2 15-year-old kids in my group that had 6-month-old babies. So I get to talk about breaking the cycle. About, like, I'm an example of breaking the cycle. I wasn't a player like my dad was. I'm faithful, you know. He was a player. And I talked to the kids about breaking the cycle. All they grew up with was sex and needles. And they think that's a normal life. Their house, you know, behind their picket fence and their grass, that's what their normalcy was. They don't know what a normal... So when I show up with my co-sponsor and they see 2 normal people they can trust, they open up and they talk. And it's amazing. And that's giving back. And, you know, that's what the program's given me. I used to be one of those guys, what can you do for me? Now it's, what can I do for you? You know, when I see a newcomer, I missed a whole group conscious because I saw a newcomer walking out right before the vote, and I went to go grab him because I could see they weren't involved and they didn't know. I went over and grabbed him, and I was outside talking while they were voting. And I ran back and says, yeah, vote me in, you know, with my vote. But, I mean, that's how important the newcomer is, you know. So I say to everybody, if you're not of service at your meeting, it can be your meeting by being of service. You know, I attend a lot of meetings, and I'm just about of service at every single one because that way I'm part of it, you know. And I'm also a GR at one of my meetings. And that's also important about being above the group level. You learn a lot more. And, you know, I always say that the traditions are the handrails for the steps because those traditions are really something. I mean, you learn a lot about group. I wish I had this program when my kids were little because my little ones, they didn't have a voice. It was what we did, what we said. And it's so much more important, I think, when everybody has a voice in the family unit just to hear an opinion so they feel they're part of, as opposed, you know, I was brought up, you know, kids are to be seen, not heard. And now, you know, with my new way of thinking, I'm trying to enlighten as many people as I can and program that. That's an old way of thinking. We can be better. I can be better, and I'm trying to be better. So, okay. So thanks for letting me share, everybody.